creatures of the light, how can you say with absolute certainty what does or does not dwell within the limitless ocean of the night? Are the dark, enshrouded legions of evil not but figments of the imagination, because you and your puny conceit say they cannot exist? Whence came the story, told in frightened whispers down through the ages, of witch and warlock, werewolf and vampire, and all the spawn of hell, born on the sable wings of night to the unholy communion of the witch's Sabbath?
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Do the appropriate music. No. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books, and especially Forgotten Horrors Volume 5, The Atom Age, by John Woolley, Jan Allen Henderson, and yours truly. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
Thank you very much. That voice, of course, belongs to Michael Price, writer of a great many things, including the Forgotten Horrors series. Michael, glad to be back with you, talking about another one of these old spookers, as you like to call
them.
One that I think has the distinction, a distinction that none of the others have, and that is that it has an Academy Award winner in its cast, which we'll talk about a little bit later on.
Well, all right.
And let's give the folks, we're talking about Dead Men Walk this time on the Forgotten Horrors Podcast.
Not to be confused with Dead Man Walking.
That's right. And if we want to, I guess the best way to do a brief synopsis is that George Zucco plays two brothers, one a kindly professor who looks an awful lot like Edward Van Sloan in some of the shots, and
Definitely.
The other a mean guy who comes back from India. And he's full of the occult business, and we don't see this, of course, but prior to the film actually starting, the good George Zucco has thrown the bad George Zucco off a cliff in self-defense. They're having his service when the picture actually starts, the service for the bad guy, and at the time that happens, the woman who kind of functions as a Greek chorus, Fern Emmett,
the consummate nosy housekeeper.
And that's exactly what she's doing here, breaks up the funeral in jig time by saying, you know, why would you be looking at this horrible, I'm paraphrasing here, of course, but, and that kind of goes throughout. At any rate, you've got essentially, before it's all over with, you've got Mary Carlisle as the niece of the good George Zucco, who's being...
What a lovely ingenue, Mary Carlisle.
Yes, she was. And this is her last film, too. This was her final film.
Yes, and it's just such a doggone pity that she vanished when she should have been catching on. Of course, she had her major studio credentials,
she
too.
She did.
But
did she move back and forth, or did she go from the major studio to Poverty Row? Do you recall?
Set of circumstances that drove Maris Rickson from Warner Brothers down to Monogram Pictures. You got to work. What does an actor do? Well, an actor acts. Wasn't it Clu Gulager that said that?
Clu Gulager said that to me. He says an actor acts. That writers write and actors act.
Yes, exactly.
But the case with Maris Rickson and with Mary Carlisle and with others, I would assume, Wanda McKay and people like that once you were in Poverty Row, you didn't dig yourself out?
Well, once you were in it, unless you were John Carradine.
Right. Or other character actors, I suppose, yeah.
Yes, exactly. But of course, as with so many ingenue players, the young and innocent pretty girl type who was, you know, grist for the Hollywood mill. Doggone it, Mary Carlisle got married, and her husband said, "That's enough acting."
Mm-hmm.
and sometimes they'll marry a non-Hollywood figure, and the spouse will be so starstruck that, oh no, you gotta keep acting, you gotta keep acting. Others, no, it's like, okay, let's get out of this racket.
Right.
And when she married an aviator named Blakely, James Blakely, Mary Carlisle said, okay, I'm through.
And she was done, and that was right after this, which this is 43, correct? Yeah, 1943.
It was, yes. I believe she had married in 1942.
Okay, so this was her last time around. And it's the last time around also for Dwight Frye. Now, Dwight Frye plays the bad George Zucco character's butler or servant or whatever, and looks pretty awful.
You keep expecting Zucco to address Frye as Igor.
You sure do.
Actually, the character's name is Zolar.
Zolar, and he was apparently at this time, Dwight Frye was making films during the day and working at a defense plant. And wore himself down. He doesn't look very good, and he died, what, 3 or 4 months after this picture came out, I believe.
He cashed in very prematurely, and like in 1943, the year of the year in which he had he did some bit parts uncredited that same year. I'm just kind of checking my cheat sheet here to see. Which came first? His last two major appearances were in Dead Men Walk at Bottom of the Barrel PRC Pictures, and then Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman at Universal.
That's right.
They ran very close together. I think both came out in the spring, March and April, respectively. And of course, obviously, Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman kind of had the edge over.
Sure.
Dead Men Walk, because it had a comparatively more lavish budget, a more leisurely process of development. A Universal, even a B, or what they used to call Nervous A type Universal, could take months to complete, and PRC generally cranked them out in, well, less than a month.
Of course, his role in Dead Men Walk is bigger than it is in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman.
Yeah, he gets kind of a showy finale in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. But
yes.
The beauty of seeing these two, dare we say, iconic figures working together.
Are you talking about Zucco and Frye?
Zucco and Frye.
Yes.
Working together in the context of a good old-fashioned spooker, it's like, I don't care if it's not a Universal.
Right.
Give me some cheese here.
Mm-hmm. And we got
plenty
of cheese.
Slice it thick.
Uh-huh.
Let's put some ham on it.
There's plenty of ham on it, too.
And, of course, Zucco does this wonderful dual role thing. He does very much play the voice of reason figure that Edward Van Sloan had perfected
and
during his Depression.
And looks a little like him. Don't you think
films.
He looks a little like him in that film? Looks a lot like Edward Van
Sloan.
Well,
yes, and he's got a really, really handsome hairpiece as the benevolent
twin. That's true, yeah. Yeah.
And he knew how to work his eyes. The eyes, if you look over at Zucco over the long term, whether he's at Universal, whether he's doing a Universal B or a Fox top of the liner, whether he's playing Professor Moriarty or a mad scientist, he has glowing eyes. They're almost neon. And he knew not only how to pull that trick, but how to modulate it so it doesn't dominate a performance.
Right.
There's a wonderful primitive special effect in Dead Men Walk where Zucco thinks, well, I've seen the last of that no good son of a gun. And he's looking through a window.
On the second story.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden he sees, is it a reflection?
Mm-hmm.
looks like George. No, it's his evil brother.
That's right. That's right.
Looking in the window at him from an impossible angle.
That's right.
And the double take is priceless.
Right, right. Well, of course, Zuko gets eventually, Mary Carlisle does, thanks to Fern Emmett's meddling, she gets a crucifix around her neck, and so that kind of ends it for the evil George Zuko. Meanwhile, there's a murder or two. Fern Emmett, actually, without giving too much away, Fern Emmett
right.
puts herself in danger, and the townspeople get riled, and it's kind of a hillbilly equivalent of the peasants in the Universal Germanic films.
Not only the peasants in the Gothics, but also the posse in the Westerns.
That's right. And speaking of that...
And, of course, we're talking about a studio that made, oh, gosh, perhaps more Westerns than anything else.
Absolutely. And Michael, speaking of that, what in the world is Al Fuzzy St. John? Did he just wander in off a Billy the Kid set?
Oh, yeah.
At PRC?
Yeah, they were shooting those $10,000 horse operas right around the corner at
right.
PRC Pictures. And, of course, they had Hal Price, the quintessential Western sheriff,
mm-hmm.
playing the New England sheriff in this
right.
case.
Right.
And not to mention that you've got a producer and a director, the Neufeld brothers, Sam
yes.
Neufeld and Sigmund Neufeld. Sam anglicized his name to Neufeld, while Sigmund kept his Yiddish surname, Neufeld.
Right.
And they mean the same thing, but Sam had pretensions of Anglicism, and Sig stuck with the old school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Sam and Sig made Westerns.
And, boy, they cranked them out, too.
They cranked them out. What was the great story about the Neufeld unit, A.W. Hackle, and Sig Neufeld's unit were producing one of those almost interchangeable Buster Crab Westerns during the same period, and a messenger arrives at the location and says, "We got to get these horses back to the rental outfit or they're going to charge us an extra day." And there was a great conference called amongst director, producers, etc. And Buster comes up and says, "What's the fuss here?" I told him what was wrong. He said, "Let me fix that." Tells Neufeld, the director, to roll cameras. Sam calls action. Buster barges into the middle of the posse and says, "Dismount, men. We can catch them quicker on foot."
Well, of course, his sidekick on those was Al Fuzzy St. John, the
Fuzzy St. John, who was, all due respect to Gabby Hayes, but I think Fuzzy St. John was my favorite sidekick.
Favorite of the old grizzled sidekicks. Well, he shows up just unbidden in what amounts to a cameo in mm-hmm. Dead Men Walk. Finds the dead body, and then he's gone again. You never see him again. But it's obviously Al Fuzzy St. John.
Spontaneity was the watchword at PRC.
Must have been. Of course, that was the studio that let Edgar Ulmer make whatever he wanted to, as long as he brought it in under budget, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you've got a writer here that is Fred Mitten. And, you know, this is a guy who was talk about prolific. But look at the credits that Fred Mitten has in addition to so many of these. He did a lot of Westerns. He did Terror of Tiny Town.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote Harlem on the Prairie, one of those Herb Jeffries.
One of the Herb Jeffries Harlem
Baker.
Out West pictures.
Yeah, the Bob Baker pictures. And also, he wrote Nabonga.
Yes.
So you've got someone there who is really, I mean, it must have been, you want to think it was a lot of fun for those people. And I know Fred Mitten was really cranking them out because he probably wasn't making very much money. But look at the credits. When you've got Dead Men Walk, Terror of Tiny Town, and Harlem on the Prairie, That's pretty much the hat trick as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, yeah, man. Death Valley Manhunt, of course.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The Mad Monster.
Yes,
another one of those Zucco pictures.
And Glenn Strange in that case.
Now, Glenn Strange as playing a cross between... playing a cross between Lenny Small and Larry Talbot.
That's right. That's amazing. Exactly right. That's dressed like Lenny from Of Mice and Men, and still with that kind of "I don't want to be this monster" Larry Talbot thing. You're absolutely right.
Yes, exactly. And of course, if we may digress for a moment, that was a joke that Glenn Strange played on his pal Lon Chaney.
Oh, I did not know that.
Oh yes, I'm going to play this like Lon Jr. would.
Yeah, like
except
you did
I'm
in,
play
like you did in Ed of Mice and Men.
Exactly. And when my uncle's movie theaters in the 40s ran these pictures, my uncle Grady Wilson would address the crowds about coming attraction. He wouldn't just turn on the projector and let the trailers run. And he said, "Hey, in the case of the Mad Monster, he told his audiences, say, we got this little picture coming up. Now I know we got a built-in audience and for this, but I'll bet you if any of y'all remember Of Mice and Men fondly, you're going to want to see this."
Nice.
Oh, Pedro, you startled me. What's the matter? Why do you stare at me like that?
I don't know, Miss Lenore. I feel funny. I smell something in the mist coming up out of the swamp. It's like a voice talking to me, telling me to do something. Something terrible.
Oh, but that isn't real. That's just your imagination. You mustn't pay any attention to what that voice seems to be saying.
And he doubled his business, of course.
Wow, just by putting it in a different context.
Just by putting it in a different context and getting a lot of people, if you preach to the converted, as the saying goes, all you're going to get is converted.
That's right.
The ready-made audience.
Mm-hmm.
You open these opportunities up to people who might be kind of curious. It's like, oh, Chaney Jr., this guy, okay, well, of course. And knowing today, the funny backstory is that for years and years and years, you know, Glenn and Lon Jr. were both boisterous blue-collar types.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't hang with the Hollywood elite. They caroused with the roustabouts.
The Andy Devines and the Rod Camerons and those guys.
Yeah, exactly. Sure. And Glenn Strange told George Turner and me once while we were doing some early research on these Forgotten Horrors things, said, Chaney ribbed me about that for years, and I ribbed him right back.
Well, you told me something about Dead Men Walk, that it was a first of something, and I cannot remember. We were talking about this informally a couple of months ago, but I can't remember what you told me.
Don't you just love those conversations that evaporate?
Right. Well, I know
I said something, but
yeah.
what you're thinking of, John, is that Dead Men Walk is a pride of place picture. It's the first vampire picture, and that's of course what Zucco's welcome affliction is.
Yes.
The first Gothic-styled vampire picture to be set on American soil.
Aha.
I could look up some dates here, but why bother? Just take my word for it.
Right.
Beat Son of Dracula, which is set in Louisiana.
Yes.
Beat Son of Dracula to the box office by a good little stretch.
Well, I know it's the first and only, I think, PRC vampire film. I believe that is correct as well. And the first, perhaps even the first Poverty Row vampire film. You'd have Vampire Bat, wouldn't you?
And of course, Condemned to Live.
Condemned to Live,
of course, those were not in any sense conventional vampire pictures.
Right.
There are variations at work here in Dead Men Walk as well. I mean, the guy's a Satanist primarily, but he also has this vampire business about him.
Yes, and of course, once again, it falls to poor Fern Emmett to tell everybody what to do to kill the vampire, and I guess George Zucco, the doctor, takes it seriously about mm-hmm. burning the coffin.
It's, and of course that allows for the classic conflagration finale.
That's right. That's exactly
which is
right.
Like, gosh, I think we're about to run out of film here. What should we do? Oh, set everything on fire.
That's right. It's the equivalent of having somebody, the whole cast, run over by a truck. And that's pretty much what happens at the end of Dead Man. You know, I've seen the reviewers and the people who write about old horror films have not been particularly kind to Dead Man Walk. I read several different treatments of or analyses of Dead Man Walk, mm-hmm. and I think maybe they're being a little bit hard on it. I enjoyed the picture quite a little bit.
Well, of course, it's quite fashionable, and it has been since 30 years ago, if not more. It's been very fashionable to just pull out the snarkisms.
Right.
The customary snark is, well, here's a picture. It looks like it was made for about $1.98.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, yeah, okay. Uh-huh. Number one, don't take that literally. Number two, we kind of know pretty much, generally speaking, what PRC spent on its pictures.
Yes.
And we know that they got a lot of bang for the buck. They know not to expect finery except in the sense of spontaneity and a willingness to experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And what wonderful little bits of improvisation. You mentioned Fuzzy St. John showing up. I have no doubt but what the character is not in the script.
Yes.
The character, you know, somebody says, hey, Sam, you got to, is Fuzzy over there on the western lot? Yeah, well, bring him over here. We need him to discover a body. And then you've got that wonderfully atmospheric face in the flame.
Yes.
Image at the first of the picture.
And that is Forrest Taylor.
That is Forrest Taylor,
yes. Who's supposed to be, from my readings about the picture, he's supposed to be Satan, apparently. Of course, Forrest Taylor is another huge Western presence. How many dozens of Westerns did Forrest Taylor make?
I'm sure probably our generation first saw Forrest Taylor on the Warner Brothers TV Westerns, Lawman, for example.
Yes.
On the, Whispering Smith.
Yes, yes.
Showed up on Overland Trail, Wanted Dead or Alive, Maverick, of course, speaking of Warner's Westerns. And it's like, there's more depth to this guy than just the TV characters. And sure enough, you can catch him backing up Roy Rogers. You can catch him lending extreme richness of incidental character to, oh gosh, some of the I'm not flashing on the title, but one of the Ma and Pa Kettle comedies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah.
He's got the kind of face that stands up even in an unbilled part.
That's right, which is basically
even when he's just
case.
Riding with
yeah.
the posse.
That's basically the case, of course, in Dead Man Walk. Of course, he's the first face that you see, too.
He's the first face that you see, and it's like, well, this one's going to be this. I can tell, low budget be damned, this is one little creepy picture.
Mm-hmm. And I think it is creepy. And, you know, as much as I the interesting thing about George Zucco, well, number one, he's a book burner, you know, and I hate to have a book burner for a hero, but I guess in this case it's justified because he has to burn his brother's occult tomes, I suppose, to keep him from falling into the wrong hands. But if you really look at the picture, George Zucco gets into more fights than the nominal hero, which is Nedrick Young.
Yeah, Zucco was a very athletic, burly guy.
Yes, he was. And I have to say, you know, I kind of teased at the beginning, the Oscar winner that we have in this cast is Nedrick Young. And I did a little research on him. He was caught up in the Tail Gunner Joe stuff and the House Un-American Activities, Hollywood, mm-hmm. the Red Scare in Hollywood in the 50s.
Right.
And changed his name. He was blacklisted, then changed his name to Nathan E. Douglas and co-wrote The Defiant Ones in the 50s and won an Oscar for that. He also co-wrote Inherit the Wind. Now, here's a guy, here's the a pretty wooden hero in the PRC mold who becomes a Class A screenwriter after being ostracized by McCarthy and by the Un-American Activities Committee.
Now, oh,
I think that was just pretty
and
doggone
his,
good.
His writing credentials, well, he very briefly helped to turn Elvis Presley into a kind of a film noir protagonist with Jailhouse Rock.
Was he one of the scripters on Jailhouse Rock as well?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, very good.
One of the scenarists.
Oh, very good. Very good. Well, I'm glad to know he made something of himself because he didn't really seem to have much of a leading man future. I think he's really kind of the weakest part of the picture, don't you?
He's awfully bland.
Yeah, he's bland.
Especially even in good guy mode, George Zucco is formidable.
Yes.
He was my brother. Yet he always seemed an alien soul, even in childhood. I believe he hated me all his life. After he returned from India, Elwin was like a man obsessed by a demon. Nothing was sacred to him. He had nothing but contempt for all that decent men hold dear. His mind became a black and evil thing, probing into the perverted knowledge of ancient sorcery and demonology.
Have been insane.
We're all quick to call insane any mentality that deviates from the conventional. There have been many things in heaven and earth undreamed of in our philosophy.
Yes, I agree.
He has no compunctions about dispensing retribution.
And you know,
but of course, Ned Young had a fairly long career, on into the 60s. Once he got the Un-American Activities nonsense over with.
But his career was largely as a writer, wasn't it, Michael?
Primarily as a writer, but he also continued with supporting parts, bit parts.
Well, you can
uncredited parts, and of course, if you've seen the name Ned Young, there you go.
Right, right. Well, you can pick this film up for not very much money. It must be in public domain, I'm assuming.
Like most of the PRCs.
Yes,
yes.
That would be right. Yeah, the PR. Nobody ever
bothered
to renew the copyright.
There's a very passable edition out from Alpha Video.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it shows up on, well, heck, I've seen it. I've seen it, a very good print of Dead Men Walk on Turner Classic Movies Network.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, it's worth a look. We think we can recommend this for people who like, and you do really get a little bit of the old shock theater vibe, that whole deal. With PRC, unlike Universal, you're not quite sure where they're going to go. It was like, I remember the Corman film, seeing them in the theaters in the 50s, and mm-hmm. they were just structured so differently than the regular pictures you were used to seeing that you just really didn't know what you might see in those.
They had a whole lot less to lose.
Yes.
Even in their B movies, low-budget pictures, their so-called B unit, Universal Pictures, always had a sense of responsibility to the investors.
Absolutely, yeah.
PRC was more of a seat-of-the-pants operation. They were in the business to make money, but they were also in the business to have fun, to mm-hmm. dig out an unused prop from the scene dock and say, hey, let's write a scenario around this raggedy old prop.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's how Bela Lugosi's Devil Bat ends up in one of the PRC Westerns.
Yeah.
Wild Horse Phantom.
Being chased, or rather chasing Al Fuzzy St. John, as I recall.
Speaking of Fuzzy St. John.
There you go, he's ubiquitous. First of all, I should say that the Bloody Vision cards from last time went to Richard McMahon of Sedalia, Mo.
Sedalia,
Missouri.
Great.
Yeah. So now, and I've taken the liberty of telling Joey that we can give away. I have some here, and I know you have some. We can give away some of the original, out of print Southern Fried Homicide graphic novels that you
published
and I was able to be a part of. I have a little story in that Southern Fried Homicide. And we're going to do that. And Joey's going to tell folks, if they're the least bit interested in winning something like this, how they're going to do it. Then I'll be back with you and we'll plug a little bit and then we'll go home.
Just the ticket.
All right. Here is our, and folks, here is our producer.
Hello.
Hi, Joey.
I'm Joey. And I'm an alcoholic.
Come
no,
on in.
Not yet. We may pop a couple after this is over. Joey Hambrick, our producer, is with us. Joey, I'm going to turn it over to you. Here's the headphones.
Thank you, John. For the next couple of weeks, we'll be posting in the Forgotten Horrors podcast group different things about the related to the books and the podcast. And anybody who shares these items on Facebook will be put in the running to win one of many copies that we have available to give away of Southern Fried Homicide. So until the next episode is put up, share early and often. And thank you very much. This makes me feel weird, so I'm going to hand it back to John.
Thank you, Joey. And because we wanted to have Joey come in on that one, Michael, because I had no idea what he's talking about, but I assume that the people who are listening know. You probably even know because you're pretty hip to Facebook and stuff.
Oh yeah, I'm sure we've got a base of participation that. Well, I'm very grateful for the attention.
Absolutely. So, what you're speaking of being grateful, what do you want to plug that you've got out most recently?
Oh golly, I just I got so many irons in the fire. I don't know what to make of it. It's we've been doing the new createspace.com web catalog lately.
Oh, okay. And you, I know that all the Forgotten Horrors books are on that.
All the Forgotten Horrors books are on that. They've always been available at Amazon.com.
Right.
And now. Let me just refresh myself. We have started now to develop the CreateSpace web catalog for the umbrella group Cremo Studios.
Cremo Studios.
The cream o the books.
Mm-hmm.
And so far so good. We'll anyone who's involved with Facebook can do a checkup on. My Facebook page, that's Michael H, middle initial H, P-R-I-C-E, and see some of the new web store developments. It's a continuing process. It's like, if you're going to be putting out these books, the objective is to get them seen as widely as possible.
That's right.
And to make them as accessible as anybody wants them to be. It's
right.
A whole new, let me see what have I got in my pocket. Right here in the pocket in the coin purse, I've got two nickels and a paradigm. And the paradigm keeps shifting.
Very nice. And, of course, your web page is linked to our Forgotten Horrors web page, I'm assuming.
Yes, yes. And, boy, am I ever delinquent at bringing that Forgotten Horrors blog up to date.
Yeah, and I've been pretty delinquent, too. I heard from our friend our friend Craig Lamb not long ago. I saw where he had posted with us. And we have quite a few people. Craig Lamb, of course, is probably knows just about as much about horror movies as anybody, especially the classic horror movies. And I was glad to see him posting. I have to say, I've got a couple of things that might be of interest. One is my Shot in Oklahoma book has just been named by the Oklahoma Historical Society as the outstanding book on Oklahoma history for 2011.
Whoa.
So I guess it wasn't just, but it was in the past few months.
Nice work if you can get it.
Thank
that's
you.
Wonderful.
It's available on a website. No, that's not right. It's not available on the website. It's available from Amazon.com and also from OU Press, University of Oklahoma Press. The other thing is we have floated, John McMahon and myself, have floated the first book from our brand new imprint, which is Reverse Karma Press. And may I say to whoever's listening that the idea of Reverse Karma came from Michael H. Price. And the idea of digging up and celebrating people from the past who may be under-celebrated, in the hopes that perhaps someone's going to do it for us in the future, is the way I understand it from Michael. And we are actually, this is not going to be available really on a wide scale until the Christmas season of 2013, but we have a new book called Hardboiled Christmas Stories.
Ah, yes.
Hardboiled Christmas Stories is a collection of pulp stories from the 30s and 40s that have Christmas Yuletide settings, but they're also got murder. Yuletide homicide is kind of the theme. They're all reprints. Some of the greatest pulp names like Steve Fisher and John K. Butler, John Lawrence are in it, and D.L. Champion. And Robert Leslie Bellum, who is my favorite pulp writer of the bunch, never wrote a Dan Turner Hollywood Detective Christmas story, so I wrote one in his style, and that's in the book.
Splendid.
We just had a test pressing. We printed a few. Our printer is here in Tulsa, and we have printed a few, and if you want to know how to order them, you can go to the Reverse Karma Press website, which is just reversekarmapress.com. My son Steven is working on that right now, and it'll tell you how to order them. And we'd be glad to see what you think. I realize it's not the Christmas season anymore, but you know, it's never too early to do your Christmas shopping. So I think
it's never too early to get your fix on Forgotten Horrors. I should mention also, more than in passing, Craig Scott Lamb has instituted a really nice new page on Facebook called Ape Suit Cinema.
Ape Suit Cinema, okay.
Which now I need to link that up with the Forgotten Horrors Facebook page.
Absolutely.
Boy, I tell you what, just when you think you know everything there is to know about guerrilla movies.
Uh-huh. Well, Michael, it's like being the fastest gun in the West. You know, you always know there's somebody out there who's faster than you are.
Well, I've been enjoying this page that Craig Lamb has put together immeasurably, and the photos are just like, wow, this is behind the scenes stuff. This goes, takes its cue from Charlie Gamora,
yes.
Ray Corrigan, the great ape impersonators. I think even a lot of guerrilla movie fans are going to be surprised to see the extent of the knowledge being put forth here.
Well, good. I think that's great. And I hope Craig wouldn't mind. I bet he wouldn't if we linked it up to Forgotten Horror's website, too.
Oh, I think it comes with the territory.
Well, Michael, one of the New Year's resolutions I've put forward is to see if we can do this podcast a little bit more often. And I hope that maybe we can get on a... What do we want to do, Joey? What do we want to shoot for in 2013, do you think? How many?
Well, at least 12,
says Joey. You think we've got that in us, Michael?
Let's shoot for the monthly pattern, and if we beat that, so be it. And if we get a little bit ahead of the game, we might slack off at one point or another.
And meanwhile, we sure would like to plug one more thing. I'd sure like, if anyone is interested in... In our graphic novel of The Miracle Squad, which was a fictional Hollywood studio in the 1930s, the stories originally came out from Upshot Graphics, which was Fantagraphics, they have been recollected. We've got a lot of B-picture content in those that came from our friend Bill Cunningham, the mad pulp bastard out in L.A. at Pulp 2.0 Press, we want to send a shout-out. That Bill did the layout on that, just a fantastic job on the layout. One of the things he wanted me to do was cast the people in the Miracle Squad as though I were casting a movie, and so I was able to, as you well know, I was able to get some stills of people who would be my dream cast if the Miracle Squad ever became a movie. And let's also turn people toward Forgotten Horrors 5 and Forgotten Horrors Comics and Stories, which are the most recent, along with your expansions of the first two books, and how about your soundtrack album?
Well, yeah, the music of Forgotten Horrors,
yes.
CD collection is going great guns on the looks like it's really racking them up at several web catalogs. I've got to get the new web catalog page reserved for that. Those who are listening, if everybody will pull over to the Facebook page for Forgotten Horrors podcast, I'll be putting up new links to the new web catalog for these Forgotten Horrors titles.
Great. And let me kind of close by saying, in the words of Don Red Berry in the Western fanzines of the 70s, if every one of you will send me a dollar, we can make the kinds of Westerns that you can take your family to see. So if everyone will send us a dollar, we'll make the kinds of podcasts you want to hear. Michael, thank you. It's been a pleasure. As always, we'll be back in touch very soon.